In Burns Lake, they used that, and then they used the Indian Act, and the Indian Act is like way out there. It was made in 1877.
And
so
charges, and
they charged us for breaking and entering into the band office when we were actually there. We had the NDP office in Burns Lake. A fellow by the name of Christensen was the secretary at that gardener's office in Burns Lake, and we called him up and we said, listen, we need an appointment with our social services worker because our elders are being denied social assistance in the reservation. And he booked us an appointment. When we got there, they called the police and they had us all arrested and all thrown in jail, and like it was just like a continuous harassment by the RCMP, propagated by not only the chief and council were working together, but the grand chief was married to Shirley Meldrum, and Shirley Meldrum was the crown prosecutor prosecuting all of us that were being forcibly relocated off our land. So there's sort of a conspiracy between the grand chief, his wife, who was the crown prosecutor, in Smithers, the federal crown prosecutor, who was railroading all of us through the court system, giving us all like just things that we couldn't deal with, and taking our kids away, and we had to run and hide in the mountains. That's how we ended up in the United Nations. We drove across the country on our own and went to New York City because they totally evicted us and they were throwing us in jail. So
well,
we
that's
had to get
good
away.
For you. That's a lot of spirit. That's
well,
it, like
well
that.
We had to otherwise because we have a nephew doing 18 years maximum prison penitentiary time. He was sent to jail when he was 16 years old, and then one of the other kids, he was only youth too. The RCMP actually fired his gun in the back seat of the car at the kid, not just through the floor though. So they use actually these kind of terrorist tactics on us. We take a look at what they're doing at all the other standoffs that like Gustafson Lake in BC, you know. They use the paramilitary on us. They use actually mines, you know, and that's actually waging war on our people for what? You know, these guys were sun dancers at Gustafson Lake. And that was Eudes Dossens. He was the Attorney General that time, and there was this whole, to me it was a conspiracy because they used their puppet chiefs at the Assembly of First Nations to come and get involved, and I just like they wouldn't real deal with us as the grassroots people at that level.
How do they manage to get the chiefs on their side? Like how do they end up being puppets? How does that come to be?
The chiefs are really working for the federal and provincial government, and they side with the RCMP in every community in this province, because when they call the RCMP on us, the RCMP picks us up, charges us, and takes us to outside of town and says, you have to leave. You're not allowed back here again. That's what the RCMP tells us. And a lot of times, the charges that they've given us, we go to court for 4 or 5 years before they put a state proceedings on them. And a lot of charges Frank and I went through all over the last 25, 30 years together, a lot of charges that were menial little things that would last us 4 or 5 years in a court system. And if we plead not guilty, we're beaten up like... We're beaten up really bad by the RCMP and sheriffs in the courtrooms. And the last beating that we took was from the Oliver Courthouse, where we were charged for being illegal aliens in Canada. We went to court there for 5 years before we got badly beaten up. And
physically?
Yeah. Gave us brain damage, mangled my hands with a handcuff so that I couldn't do nothing with my hands anymore. And Frank, his face was all smashed up and beaten up by 10 Vancouver City policemen in Gastown. And there was a videotape taken of those 10 policemen beating him up. And we lived through all those beatings. And the very last beating Frank took was, I was a witness to that beating. He got beaten up by a real huge RCMP officer from the Abbotsford Police Station. And this RCMP officer lied on the stand to the judge, saying that Frank was obstructing the police officer by driving away on him. And through the many beatings we took together, I think that that was viable, that Frank drove away from this guy. But when he did stop him, he used a stranglehold on Frank, and that stranglehold put Frank to sleep. It was like a sleeper, and then they try to say to the police, try to lie to the judge, telling him that Frank was abusive and swearing and everything in a van, in a police car back seat. There, when I saw them take Frank away, he wasn't even sitting up; he was laid out. I thought he was dead. And then when they took him to the Chilliwack police station that day, they had to call in the ambulance to revive him because that police officer used a stranglehold on him. And later on in court, I found out that this police officer had a black belt in judo.
Wow.
Yeah. So on that whole idea that they pulled me over until outside by Abbotsford, and they beat Helen up on the highway and left her and my daughter with her scooter on the highway because she can't walk, and took the van away. And after they beat me up, they beat her up because she needed to use the washroom, and she couldn't go to the washroom, and she went in the washroom in front of those 10 police officers that had detained all of us on the highway. And all of this came from was because we were at John Graham's court, and so we said John Graham's getting extradited to the United States by the American government because he's a fighter for uranium mine interests. Anyhow, we were in his courtroom, Supreme Court in Vancouver.
He's for uranium?
He's against the uranium mining on indigenous lands, and he's one of us.
Okay.
And we were standing up for him in a courtroom for quite some time now, and CSIS department in Division E in Vancouver here had an officer testifying that had arrested him at that time for the charge he's going up on, so that they can get him into the United States in South Dakota, where this incident happened. Incidentally, in South Dakota, there were 60 indigenous peoples who were killed at that time that John Graham was found there. So it wasn't just the one person, Animeyakwas, there were 60 other indigenous people were killed. So to me, we were sort of defending him because of the facts that we're dealing with, not just with his case, but with the freedom of Leonard Peltier, because Leonard Peltier's case relates to John Graham's case. But Division E was involved in arresting not just John Graham; they were involved in arresting Leonard Peltier and extraditing him. And because Division E was involved in the extradition case, Division E actually had that officer on the highway waiting for us to pull us over and take our vehicle away so that we can be demobilized, not returned back to his court. However, due to the circumstances, our network is a little bit stronger, and we have a lawyer to come and represent us in that courtroom. And I got a $10 fine for obstructing peace officer, even though I didn't do anything wrong at that time. And I still got severe beatings from him. And I still find it kind of like outrageous that the Canadian taxpayers would be paying taxes to let the government carry on and conduct themselves in such a manner when they signed a peace accord with the United Nations and stuff like that. And your question was earlier was how did the chiefs become chiefs in the territories? Well, to make a long story short, the government had long-range plans, so they set up the residential schools and they made clones within the residential school system. And their clones are now in power, and they're all menfolk.
Okay, so with our white man ways,
the ways that they were taught by the Catholics, with the Catholic school system,
right?
And then there was some of them were given law degrees through the University of British Columbia, even though they didn't really go through the whole program. They still were given degrees so that they could have somebody to negotiate the resources and the land away with. Mm-hmm. And it would be all legal under the so-called common law, I would think. But to me, it still violates our rights because there are still no treaties or agreements here. Anyhow, they were cloned by the residential schools, and there's this whole thing of nepotism, the chain of events went on around the nepotism within that whole family that were cloned. So from that generation on, it was passed down. So the family stayed in power for so many generations now and have continuously made and signed agreements and made deals with the federal government.
It's three generations.
Relating to mining and to making the contaminated water and stuff like that, and selling off of our water. That's why I say, you know, if the people want power, they should look at us, because they can't really ratify the North American Free Trade Agreement in Canada, because there's really no treaties in British Columbia, and the puppets that they had cloned is finally coming to the surface now, and the public at large is starting to realize that they are dealing with puppets and not with the people, and that the real people power is the woman folk in our societies. They're the clan mothers, and now they've finally been reinstated and re-empowered in our communities. So you're going to start to see more and more a constructive pattern and a pattern of unification between not just ourselves and our land base, but ourselves and our families, but ourselves and society in general. And I think it's really going to be really interesting. I really hope that the public at large would really take a grasp at that too, and take a look at what's going on with war and peace. And one of the reasons why that we work to that end is because the women are the bearer of all our children, and they're the keepers of our sacred circle. So.
Okay. Is there any groups on our end of things, on the invaders' end, that you trust, that you think could be of assistance to you?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. I took a look at Che Guevara and how he worked with Marxist-Leninists and all those other parties down there, the Communist Party. And I took a look at the Liberals. I tried the NDP. I looked at the Green Party. I looked at the Marijuana Party. I looked at all the parties. And the only party that really ever gave me a platform was the Marxist-Leninist Party. And I've actually ran up in northern BC for federal elections against Miles Richardson, who was going for the treaties in British Columbia. He was one of the treaty chiefs, and went up there when the federal election was going on, and boycotted the agreements in principle that were being made in northern BC. And then when provincial elections were on again, I ran again with the support of my wife and my family, and did a lot of good things in relationship to doing public interest stuff.
Okay. So what are you going to be doing in the future? Would you like to speak?
Yes, I'd like to say that. Now, the Olympics that's going on, 2010 Olympics, a lot of the negotiators and sellouts are all government-elected chiefs of that territory. Many of them have taken tons of money already and used the Swiss bank to take this money from people in the government in this province and this Canada, too, and take it over there, and they can spend it that way. And a lot of them are not real chiefs, except that they work for the government. The real chiefs are people like Harriet Nahaney and
Chief Capilano
are the hereditary chiefs. And these chiefs have been chiefs for generations and generations. And the treaty chiefs, the government chiefs, have only been in power for three generations now. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to see an end to that kind of government chief, because they're not doing nothing for us except for themselves. If you drive on any reservation in this town, in this city, province of BC, you can see who's a rich Indian person or a rich First Nation chief on their lands, because they have all the SUVs. One of the counselors on my reserve used to drive a limousine.
Okay,
you know?
Yeah.
And you find them all in casinos or in bingo halls. You don't find them working for the people or on their lands.
Yeah. So we have 10 minutes now. So I'd like, would you guys maybe share what your plans are for the future, like what action you're taking and how people that may want to help, if you're inviting help, how they may help, like what we could do?
Well, the future plans is to keep working with the peace movement that come out of this peace forum, and keep up the real hard, like, it has to be a continuous, really hard spin because there's so much to do and so little time to do it, because the way the things are going with the Bush administration and with the Harper administration here, we have to sort of really work hard and do some really serious networking, not just in the Americas, but like on a global level. But mm-hmm. I think specifically we'll be targeting the Americas, like Venezuela and, you know, South and Central America and up here, because this is where we find our strength will be. And Telqua has a website that she's put up, and that's, and we work out of our home up in Harrison Hot Springs. So we'll, and one of the main things that we do is we work at Family Night every Wednesday night in Vancouver. We have over 500 people gather and meet and have Family Night, and we do a little bit of networking there. So those are the kind of things that we have going. And to actually promote some of the things that we're doing, we have artwork that we sell too, and anyone that's interested in supporting some of the work that we do can contact us through our website, and I'll let Telqua explain all that, how she can be contacted.
Okay.
I'd like to mention one issue that's really on my mind, because in the 1940s, all my grandparents had to stand up and fight for us, and they couldn't leave their land or the reservation system unless they had a green card, and that was in the 1940s. In the 1950s, they had to, when they were trying to bring up this land claims issue and speak of land rights, they were jailed or put in Ocala or BC Penn. Those jails were made specifically for our indigenous people of this land who were fighting out or speaking out for their land rights. And now it's 2006, and our children are being attacked. And it started when Frank's court case was going on in Abbotsford in the last 2 years. Now they've attacked our children. And a lot of the youth on the street of Vancouver, especially on Commercial Drive, is the only home that they know. A lot of the kids have no homes because a lot of their parents and grandparents were evicted off their lands in B.C. so that they can make way for the B.C. Treaty. And the stealing of trap lines and stealing of our indigenous names to the trap lines of our territories is being done by the government elected chiefs. And I think people,
could you explain trap lines?
Our trap lines is our territories. Like my grandfather and my father were given these trap lines by the BC government so that we could hunt and live off that land and feed our families through that land. And we had the biggest trap line in our territory, which was 220 acres of land where we picked berries and dried salmon and canned salmon, dried moose meat and dried berries and on and on. And we had underground storages where we, back then, we didn't have no electricity and no freezer, so we had to can our goods and put it underground. And even potatoes that we grew, we had to put it underground for winter use. And those things were like, that's how our people lived, you know. And then when the government chief councils came in, they brought in electricity power and that with them, and freezers and everything that's modern today. And so our people were forced off their territories, and that's why a lot of our youth are on Commercial Drive and a lot are down on Hastings Street too. And now we have not, since this 2010 Olympics started, a lot of our youth and us ourselves, and I've seen a lot of elders, indigenous elders on the drive too, that are forced off the Commercial Drive by a thing they call red zoning, and
yeah,
red zoned a lot of our people. And food, free food and clothing that they used to get used to be given out at Grandview Park. And that's where a lot of the Chili Line, the Salvation Army brings food to the poor people. Now, because of the red zoning, our people are just starving to death now. They have nobody. So whenever I can, I feed some of those poor people and I listen to their stories of how they are forced into one spot. It's like corralling us onto the reservation system in the early 50s and 60s, and now they're corralling them into different areas in Vancouver now because of the 2010 Olympics. And those people have no voices. Yesterday I spoke to one young man, and his girlfriend was sitting down beside him, and she was trying to put an elastic band on her shoes to keep her soles from falling off, you know.
Wow.
That's how starving these people are, and they're homeless. There's no, nobody gives them clothes, or nobody even gives to think about them, you know. And even a jug of water would help, you know, because it's so hot out there. And a lot of our youth are red zoned. And that red zoning is illegal because the RCMP and the police do it themselves. Mm-hmm. They don't go through the justice system to get that red zoning ticket. And I think that a lot of our people need support in the courtrooms because they put them all through the courts. And they railroad them through the courts once they're there because none of them have no help. The Legal Services Society don't help. The Native court workers are useless because they just hang around the... One day when we were in the courtrooms, there was 5 Native court workers, but there's nobody there. Now, how much money do those people get to supposedly support us?
They don't show up?
They don't speak out like we do.
Oh, okay.
We speak out on every issue we can. We help our people. We feed our people.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I really would like to see again that I did in the past was when I got on radio program like this, I went and asked people for things that we need. Like, when our people need clothing, our people need shoes, our people need homes. A lot of things that our people need, you know. We're living in a condition that's unbelievable. And 50 years ago when I saw all this happening, you know, we never thought of our people going hungry, our people dying on the street, our people just, nobody cares about them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's even worse. And it's worse on a reservation system because they only get $185 a month on a reserve for one person. And that $185 is a threat to them, too, because the band chief and council can just take that away from you and you end up with nothing.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, what do you do with a legal system that's not working for you? So, do you have any ideas about that? Or?
Yeah, actually there is. When Telqua and I go to court, I represent her, she represents me. Mm-hmm. And I take an advisor, and my advisor is a lawyer named Dorothy O'Donnell. But when you go to court and you stand in front of the judge, it's often better if you stand in front of the judge yourself and explain your disposition to him. And more often than not, the judge will listen to you before he'll listen to the Crown Counsel, because the Crown Counsel is just taking the information from the police. So because of how the judicial system is geared, there's not very many judges also that would listen to you. So maybe 1 out of 10 judges that I've had would actually hear me. So I would have to go through 10 different judges before I'd find the right one. And sometimes that's what it takes. You have to be very patient in that system.
Mm-hmm.
And I always told my wife and my kids, you know, if you ever get caught up in the justice system, get out of it as fast as you can. And when my daughter got red zoned off Commercial Drive, we went to the courthouse and explained to the judge that she's a family kid, you know, like she's no threat to society. And she was actually charged for possession of marijuana on Commercial Drive. I mean, Commercial Drive is well known for marijuana, and she's a youth. Of course she's going to be involved in youth activities and stuff. And she...
3 years.
And the Crown Prosecutor was suggesting that she get 3 years and that she be prohibited from
carrying... 3 years?
Yeah. And
wow.
She be prohibited from carrying weapons, and that her red zone go from Broadway down to Hastings. And, you know, I mean, that's her whole social life, that she got red zones for carrying 3 grams of medicine. You know, I mean, mm-hmm.
Better than seeing them in alcohol.
Yeah.
And to me, the whole idea and the whole concept of the police force tackling youth and children on the street and going after our youth is sort of like something that I have to pay attention to, because when I was 8 years old, the RCMP took me away from my family, and they took me away in a very, very rough way. And I'm going, wait a minute, now we have to start doing something about this. So
one of the things, electric shocks on you too when you're seven.
Yeah. So one of the things that we do is that we maintain a vigil on Commercial Drive and on Hastings Street and watch our people. We're sort of like International Human Rights Watch. We have NGO status because we've been involved in international issues and international tribunals in relationship to residential schools and what actually happened at those schools and stuff like that. So we have a good history of being involved in a lot of work, and that's why we say if you really want to get a hold of us, our email address is telqua@hotmail.com. That's telqua@hotmail.com. And Telqua will give you her webpage, and you can actually look at our webpage. And one of the things that you can do is punch in Helen Michelle and Frank Martin and Bear Clan and Max and Lake on Google, and you'll come up with a whole bunch of information about us. And also, we'll give you a good idea on how to get a hold of us. And that's what I suggest to you listeners. If you're very interested in finding out what we're speaking about and how you can help, that's how you can. And Wednesday night, family night at the Vancouver Indian Center on 1607 East Hastings. We're always there every Wednesday night because that's where our people gather, and that's where we share information, and that's where people come to meet us when they want to give us things too, because that's a pickup point on Hastings, the 1607 East Hastings. And
Commercial Drive.
It's on Commercial and Hastings.
Okay.
And I'd like to thank you for inviting us to the radio station to explain our disposition in relationship to the peace initiatives that this country has going. And I commend Vancouver and the peace activists for organizing and inviting us even to the forum and to get involved. And like I said, it was kind of hard for us to get up to a mic, but at the end, though, when we got to speak to all the panels that were involved in organizing the whole forum, it turned out fairly well because we got to explain to the international panel what our disposition was with the Canadian government in relationship to peace.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'm glad I invited you on because you have a very important story to tell. And
well, you're welcome to invite us again. And
okay.
Anytime.
Okay. Unfortunately, we have to
thank
go to
you.
The news.
Okay. But, cheers.
Cheers.
This is a CGSF news break.
Last week was the culmination of This Walk is for Life, a 4-year Aboriginal suicide prevention walk. I spoke with organizer Vincent Watts about what it felt like to finally complete the walk and about future plans for Aboriginal suicide prevention.
I understand this was the final year for your youth suicide prevention walk. I wanted to ask you, in your view, did you accomplish what you set out to do?
We started out to create awareness in 2003,
mm-hmm.
and we created a lot of awareness in the past 4 years.
Vincent outlined four goals that the walk started with, which were to create awareness, to create government funding, to form an international youth suicide prevention program, and to create unity. The cycle of four walks was intended to create unity between the races.
2004, we walked for the yellow race.
Mm-hmm.
First year was from Nanaimo to Ottawa. Second year was from Nanaimo to Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
And third year was from Duncan, B.C. to Ottawa, and that was for the Black Race.
Mm-hmm.
That was 2005 completed, all three of them completed. And the final year was for the White Race in the North, and that was 2006. And we completed that from Sydney, Nova Scotia, to Victoria, B.C. And that walk was completed 2006, June 21st at 2 p.m. on National Aboriginal Day at the Parliament Building in Victoria, B.C. at 2 p.m.
So what was the reception like at the Victoria Parliament Buildings? What did it feel like to complete the walk?
It was really, really good. We had really good reception. We got greeted by some of the people from Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
We had really good media coverage. been greeted with a song, like they sang songs for us, like honoring songs and welcoming songs. And it was really, it was overwhelming for us because just the completion of doing something for awareness for 4 years, completing a circle for basically all the people of the world. And a lot of tears, there was a lot of tears shed by our group. And we've had different walkers for the past 4 years, and we were really welcomed in a good way, especially by the Victoria First Nations.
Vincent provided insight into a water ceremony the walkers participated in by carrying water from the East Coast to the West Coast.
Yeah, it was to create awareness.